Good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Super excited, as always, to be here. Here with my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now a manager on our SIU investigative team. And he's waist deep in data. And that's what we're talking about. It's more talk about data. And Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, retired Northeast UPIC director and our senior director of payment integrity, overseeing all of our SIU investigative operations. Matt is also drowning in data as well. And he's been drowning in data for a very long time. And hopefully we are throwing him some lifesaver rings so that he doesn't continue to drown in data. So a lot of stuff to talk about in data. We've been spending a lot of time talking about data. As everybody knows, we've done a couple of podcasts about it. As part of the OIG Roundtable, we've also done some LinkedIn Lives. We've got another one coming up next week. Dan Olson and I doing part two of data analytics, where we're talking about a bunch more things in the data space, mostly with regard to data modeling and the life cycle of a claim, so people understand that. But there is a lot out there in the data, and data is becoming at the forefront. And for those of you that are keeping up with things, you know that CMS is doing this chili cook-off thing. You could see my face. Where basically they're asking different firms who are in the data analytic fraud, waste, abuse space to kind of put together an RFP or an RFI, really, or an RFA or whatever they're calling it. But they're calling it the chili cook-off, where, you know, firms are going to come and present their tool. The fact of the matter is that CMS already operates a number of tools. You've got FPS, the prevention system, which is used by all the UPICs, the MACs, CMS, everybody and their mother. The OIG has the DDA, the data analytics division of data analytics, DDA, where they're running stuff. U.S. attorney's offices have contracts to run data. There's a lot. And then you've got all of the firms that are out there that are selling their data analytic tools. So there's a lot out there. We'll see what happens with the chili cook-off. I think it's just another way to have a competitive edge in the environment, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, the biggest thing in data that we see, and Wade, I'll start with you, because, you know, we were both on early iterations of what's called the Unified Case Management tool, which is the official repository for cases and case management tool for the UPICs. And you and I both worked on different portions of that. I was on the development part for the tool itself. And then you were part of what's known as the HCD, or the human-centered design piece. And for those that don't know that, what that is, human-centered design, or HCD, is really how do users use the tool, the clicks, where are the pieces of the tool, and where do you click? And, you know, at the end of the day, Wade, you know this as well as anybody, when you've been through your eighth click, you've about had it. For you, maybe it might be six clicks. Maybe five. For me, it's about eight. Matt, probably two. But at the end of the day, that becomes an important piece, which then kind of gets to the point of not only the number of clicks will frustrate an investigator, but having to comb through, you know, essentially electronic reams of data versus visualization. And there are a lot of the tools have visualization. A lot of payers are also incorporating Power BI, ClickSense, and some of these other tools that are out there, Tableau, for visualization. And the important thing, Wade, I think, and this isn't a reflection on you being, you know, in the industry for a long time, and you know, maybe some might call you and Matt dinosaurs. I'm not, because I'm the youngest of the three of us, but. You know, really, at the end of the day, what happens is investigators we're visual people, and combing through data. And when we all started, late 80s, early mid 90s, the tools weren't what they were. Remember, we were using Argus. And for those that don't know it, that's a very early tool. It was nothing more than an access overlay. And it was, you had basically very limited ability to do things and manipulate data. And there was no visualization whatsoever. And so now visualization becomes important, right, Wade? And the ability to look at the data from a visual. And when we talk about visual, we're talking about, you know, graphs, charts, and you know, things like that. And that becomes an important part for you to be able to be efficient in looking at things, but also effective in finding the things that you need quickly without having to click 37 times to get to where you need.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And having visualizations does not mean you're not going to have to do the deep dive into the data at some point. You're not going to have a couple charts that are going to, you know, document a case for you, but it's just the initial view. And I think when I'm thinking about this, I'm going back to the OIG days where, like you said, we had basically a Microsoft Access database, and you'd take the information you got from running these queries and try and explain to a prosecutor what the elements of the case were, how you're going to prove it, and things of that nature. And again, ultimately, you have to get down to that granularity. But if you can start off with a chart, a pie chart, you know, we use different charts that would graphically show beneficiary sharing, where one doctor was sharing all his patient universe with another doctor. Again, on its face, that doesn't necessarily indicate fraud, but there's a lot of things that you can surmise from that. Same with geospatial options. If some member is traveling 100 miles to go to a basic clinic and he or she is passing up, you know, 30 clinics to get to this other one, there's probably a reason why they're going to that other one. But again, it's not going to work the case for you, but it's a good initial view into what you're looking at. And right now I'm looking at a lot of new leads that we're going to look at, and it is a lot of clicks, and it's, you know, there's nothing that jumps out at you. Whereas if you had ClickSense, for example, you know, you might get some charts that at least will do that initial filtering for you. So you're not looking through, as you said, thousands of leads or alerts, and it becomes apparent upfront a little bit easier. Again, you're still going to have to drill down. You're going to have to look at the data, create pivot tables and things of that nature. But the initial look should be able to grab your attention. Again, going back to the U.S. attorney presentation, or in the current day situation, trying to determine if these leads or alerts or cases are something that you want to invest resources into. So the initial visualization will really help kind of grab your attention. But again, it's not a replacement for the deep diving into the data and the pivot tables and things of that nature, but it is a big help up front.
Right. Well, and let's take it to the next level, which is that once you've got those visualizations, it helps you with the drill down that we're talking about, right? And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about one instance where on one of the projects you're working on, you got some like alert of, you know, 5,000 outlier providers and a billion claims. I know I'm exaggerating, but some ridiculous number that you could never do anything with. And the question becomes, is that because the tool's ineffective? Is it because they don't have a drill down that should be able to get you there? But one of the things that becomes obviously an important piece of this is your ability to drill down from the noise. And I know when we talked about it, one of the problems that you had was that you clicked through 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, some ad nauseum number of screens and still weren't able to get to kind of the answer to the question that you had, which was, who are the bad guys or who are the real outliers? So having the ability to drill down and get the answers that you want is both a feature that a tool should have. It's also a human-centered design piece, because by the time you've gotten through and you've spent 40 minutes, an hour, or whatever that time period is, you're spending so much time ultimately to come to the conclusion that you either were not able to drill down to where you needed to be, or when you did drill down, it didn't give you the actionable intelligence that you needed. So the visualization should be tied directly to your ability to click through to where you need to go, but also be able to find it, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of these tools, there's definitely a learning curve. They're not so user-friendly that you can just log on and it's apparent what you have to do. There's a certain learning curve. You have to take some training, and a lot of it is just spending time with the tool. The more time you spend on it, potentially too, when you're spinning your wheels a lot, it's a learning process. You're trying to make that process shorter, more efficient. but it's definitely not, most of them aren't, you know, open it up and it's that simple that, you know, different levels of investigators have different levels of tech savviness, and maybe that's what you're leaning towards referring to as old guys, and maybe we don't have the tech capabilities that people that are coming right out of college right now have. I'm not going to argue with that, but some of these programs or tools take a little bit of a little time and effort to learn them.
Yeah, I mean, the other day I called Matt and we were on Teams. I needed to call him and he opened up his flip phone. And, you know, we had, it was a great conversation. I was like, Matt, what do you got there? And he says, oh, I got this new. Yeah, it's got this new. He called me up. It was Murray Hill 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It was weird. But, you know, Wade, you bring up something.
Sir, good. Get me the diner.
Exactly. But Wade, you know, you brought up a good point, and I want to go to Matt in a second, but your good point was that even though you're going through and spinning your wheels, there is a learning portion of that, because as you're spinning your wheels to get to what you want, you're learning how to use the tool better and better and better. But the problem is that, you know, when you have a job to do, that it shouldn't be, it's like you're robbing Peter to pay Paul for one of these things. And that learning curve is still very high, particularly if you didn't find the thing that you looked for. You spent a lot of time not paying attention to what your clicks were to get where you were. And I know some of the tools that we've seen, you click and click and click, and not only do you not get what you want, but then you're stuck somewhere and you're like, how did I even get here? Right? Because you've now managed to get to some place that you don't need to be. So, you know, I think one of the things that we're doing here, we recently hired a computer engineer who is very conversant in visualization tools and is producing some really good dashboards that are very specific to the data that we've got, the client, and we're seeing some really good results on that, mostly because we're interacting with the plans. And when we interact with the plans and we understand their data better, it lets our data engineer program better. And then she's able to have conversations with our SIU investigators, which then helps her create better dashboards, so that human-centered design piece is intrinsically built into the tool that we're using. And that becomes an important piece of it. So Matt, now I want to go to you, because obviously, you know, we started doing a lot more data analytics in-house and we've been bringing a lot of these tools in. But one of the things that, you know, we know is an ongoing issue, which is an important piece, is the ability to have clean data and be able to link that data to different things. And, you know, I know, for example, one thing that we've noticed is that we're getting data and there are 100 fields, and it may be great, but the fields that we need are sometimes absolutely missing, right? Yeah. And they are required investigative fields that both help you identify your outliers, but also help you with linking your data amongst, you know, for example, pharmacy and medical, which is an important piece of that metric.
Yeah, I'll talk about two definitions of complete data. Let's start with the missing fields thing. What we've seen as a vendor, as a, you know, the vendor SIU for a plan, is the claims administrator's data gets sent to the plan and the plan uses it for its purposes. It then goes to like the program integrity branch, where the SIU is part of that. And then we get the data from them. So it's almost like a 3 or 4 step process for us to get the data. And it looks like at every step along the way, fields are taken out because it's deemed that they're not needed by whatever entity is the next on the ladder. So we've seen it where we've gotten data where there were no modifiers, no units, no NPI number of the rendering or the billing providers, in some instances, no HCPCS codes or descriptions of the codes. And it's not easy to get the, go to that ultimate source, the vendor for the claims administrator, to get the data that we need, because they need justification. It's more cost to them. So there's got to be contract modifications, and it's you know, when we get the data, we're fighting with one hand behind our backs many times because of that. So we don't get that complete data. The other definition of complete data is the lines of business that these plans have: medical, dental, vision sometimes is separate, behavioral health is sometimes separate from medical. All of those are housed separately for some of these plans. And when we get the data, sometimes we only get one or two of the lines of business, or if we do get it, they're separated. So we've got to commingle that data to get a complete picture of what a member or a recipient or beneficiary is getting in terms of care from their plan. And Matt, without that, we don't get the full picture of the history of that Benny.
And one of the problems there is when you've got that disparate data, one of the problems you have is that the data that's being created from those different lines of business may not be formatted the same way, meaning that column A for medical might have date of service. Column A for behavioral health might have patient name.
Right. And so, or they might just have different titles for those things, different headers.
Right.
So the same thing, it doesn't mesh.
And I know, you know, one of the things I know that our data engineer is doing is, you know, creating that normalization of the data. It's one of the things our statistician spends a lot of time doing, is normalizing the data, removing duplicates and the like. But, you know, it's then when you go to link your data, and when I say link your data, meaning be able to combine that data for that particular payer, because you want to have that full picture from an investigative perspective. We don't just want the medical. If we have pharmacy data, behavioral health, if there is, we want that data. We may not be doing pharmacy investigations, but the more information you have, you know, you throw the baby in the bathwater out, but it's being able to have the ability to link that data to get that fulsome picture. But in that same vein, then, when you finally are getting all that data and looking at it, an important piece from the investigative perspective is your investigative audit trail, right? Because we play with data all the time, and we may download things into a spreadsheet. And then, you know, I know one of the biggest issues that I've had historically, personally, is I do something, I manipulate the data, and manipulate, I mean, move it around a bit, look, I don't mean changing, I mean, manipulating it to create a pivot chart, do a subtotal, do something. And I often will find that when I need to reproduce that later, I can't remember the formula that I used to get the same number. And so the audit trail becomes important to be able to document your steps. And it's not so much that that needs to go into a case file, but if you are doing something where you're coming up with an overpayment amount, a potential exposure of overpayment amount, it's internally creating that personal audit trail to be able to understand, how did you get to this number and how can I go back and do it again?
Right. It's very similar to doing a financial audit where the CPA is taking his notes along with it, and those become part of the official audit, are his notes where he or she is explaining how they came to the conclusions they came to, what steps did they take, what did they look, you know, what data were they looking at, how did they combine it. You have to do the same thing when you are,
right,
I don't say manipulating data, but right, adjusting the data to focus on the areas you want to focus on. And without that, you could be in trouble if you have to go testify to that or have to defend it in an appeal.
Right.
And you can't get to that number again. Similar with the SVRS, where you don't keep the backup notes on the SVRS.
Yeah, I mean, a great example is I was deposed a week or two ago on a project I'm working on, and my deposition was about 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and probably 45 minutes or more of it was on one particular spreadsheet with calculations. I mean, it was granular. Of each cell, how did you get this number? How'd you get this number? How'd you get this number? And so it was, you know, it took a lot of time to walk through it, which was fine. They were my calculations. We did them, but tracking how I got from column A to column B, from cell one to cell two, was an important piece of that metric that you know, I needed to be conversant with. And kind of in that same vein, and to kind of, you know, wrap up this discussion, the last thing, when we're talking about the use of data tools and things of that sort, is sometimes some of the tools out there will allow different levels of permission, meaning read-only, write-only, And even in the read-only, maybe you only have access to certain things or not certain things. And I don't think that there's a right or wrong answer, because every SIU and every payment integrity team is going to have a different need within their process, whether it be vetting, whether it be investigative, whether it be overpayment and recovery. But, you know, there are some tools out there in which access can be limited. And I just want to get your thoughts on what you feel about that. And I think there's a right or a wrong answer, because I think it's going to be plan culture specific.
Yeah, for me, I'm coming from the background from the UPIC, where, you know, we were ISO certified. We had to have role-based access to every type of information, data, case information. Even some of the templates and documents were only accessible to some people in the company. And it was basically for accountability. That's the way we did it. It sometimes hampered operations, but I saw the benefit of it, you know, in terms of making sure that the security of the data was paramount.
And that's a good point when you're talking from an operational perspective, meaning that if Eric Rubenstein only has access here and Wade has access here, but I know Wade's job because I've maybe been cross-trained or whatever it is, and Wade is on some other project or gets diverted away, I can't fill Wade's role. If Wade goes out on PTO for a week and something needs to be done and I don't have that access, I think operationally that's where you're going to have that. And I think the way you circumvent that is on the day-to-day, Eric has access level 1, Wade has access level 2, 3, 4, and 5, but there's someone who could grant temporary access to Eric for, you know, other things. Where we see this is kind of an interesting thing, in EMR systems, I remember at the OIG when we would do a search warrant to an EMR company or a subpoena to an EMR company, oftentimes the EMR company would send you a link for access and they were able to limit that access. You only had read-only access and you only had access to the records that were pursuant to the court order, search warrant or the subpoena, whatever it may be. You typically would see it in a search warrant where you'd have that access, or at a subpoena, you would get, you know, it's like a limited access to whatever it is that you may have. And then you download it and, you know, the link is good for a week or 3 days, because obviously in a search warrant, you don't get 24/7 access. It's, you know, until you're done. But I think it kind of equates to the same thing. But from an operational perspective, you know, if Wade goes out for a project or is on extended PTO and something needs to be done, there has to be. So if you're going to have those permission access limitations, I think you certainly need to have somebody in-house or ready access to somebody who can flip the switch on and then flip it off, whether that be, you know, manually going in and doing it or putting in like a, you know, a time, a clock where, you know, midnight on Friday, my access goes away and it goes back, it reverts back or something. But I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. I just know that it's come up in conversations with people about how they treat certain types of access. And, you know, should someone who's a low level front end person, should they have full access to a case file, for example, or should they only have access to the medical records to upload them, or, you know, whatever it may be from different perspectives. So it's an interesting thing. I think it's one of those things where when you're in your tool, you've got to make that determination as an SIU and a payment integrity team and determine whether or not everybody should have access, or only certain people should have access, and to what extent that access is. So, you know, it's food for thought. I think some people, when they get into a tool, they just say, I want to have unrestricted access. I want to be able to see everything, and then kind of, you know, figure it out from there. But
Eric, I was on a call early this morning with the same situation. One of the plans that we're working with, doing some SIU oversight, and we had an issue where we have some of our folks doing, not going into the weeds too much, but doing some work, and then some other investigators from the plan were doing work that the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, and it was becoming a bit of a problem. And we didn't know how to make those changes in the tool. And it goes back to the learning curve. We got on the line with, you know, customer support, for lack of a better word, and they knew exactly what the ask was, and they showed us exactly how to do it. And within 10 minutes, something that had been a problem for, you know, a week or two becoming more of a problem was fixed just because we didn't know exactly how to go about it.
And the moral of the story there sometimes, Wade, is while you want to sometimes try to punch the square peg in the round hole, sometimes it's easier to just, you know, break out a hacksaw and make the square peg around, you know, make the square peg a round peg.
Yeah.
Calling the help desk sooner than later. But I think sometimes we want to troubleshoot things ourselves for a little bit. And then before you know it, you've spent 2 days troubleshooting it versus just making that phone call. So that's a piece of the puzzle. That's a piece of the puzzle too. Because sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Like, how do you know the tool doesn't have the ability to do it? I think we inherently feel like the tool can do something. And so we're trying to figure it out. At the end of the day, we might spend a day or two trying to figure something out and learn at the end the tool doesn't have the ability to do it. And then you call customer support and they say, no, it doesn't do this. And then you ask to put a help ticket in to get them to do it. And then they have to develop it and do it as an add-on or, you know, whatever it may be. So, yeah, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's a combination of the data sometimes sucks. Sometimes the users of the tool suck. Sometimes the tool sucks. Sometimes it's a combination of all the things that are out there, but you have to make lemonade out of the lemons. And so sometimes it may take a few things that you have to chip away to be able to do that. But it is important that you become conversant in the tool in whatever way that you're using it, and to be able to get the most out of it. I mean, there are so many tools out there, and you know, we see it all the time where plans are paying inordinate amounts of money for a tool and they're using 10% of the tool or 15% of the tool. So therefore, should you only be paying 10%? Or are you just not using the tool the way you should? And that's a you end problem, not a they end problem. So good discussion. As always, the data is an important piece, and you know, it's just becoming more and more important. You know, the chili kick cook-off is reminiscent of, you know, where data is an important piece and the importance of aggregating data. And making sure that you have good, clean data so that you're not tracking down false positives, which is an important thing. And the one thing that I would always say to anyone out there using a data tool is to challenge your vendor on their false positive rate. And if they give you a number that is too hard to believe, how do they get to that number? If someone is saying they have a false positive of 5% or 8%, whatever the number is, it doesn't matter. I would want to know, how did you come to that conclusion? Is it anecdotal? Did you do an empirical analysis? How did you test that your error rate is this? And I don't know what the right answer is, but I'm just saying that if you've got a tool that claims to have a very, very low error rate, I want to know how you calculated that error rate. And if they have a very high error rate, is that a tool that you should be using? And I think you have to look at the different ends of the spectrum to see what it does for you and make those independent assessments as it relates back to your data and your tool. So ongoing discussions, as always, we appreciate it. So stay tuned. You know, we got that. We've got part two of our LinkedIn Live. Dan Olson and I be talking about more data things and continuing our conversations going forward. We've got a bunch of LinkedIn Lives going through till the end of the year. We're going to talk a lot more about data on upcoming LinkedIn Lives. And again, we appreciate everybody taking the time to tune in to our weekly podcast and letting us know what you think of the three of us. Really, what you think about Wade and Matt. I don't really care to hear what people think about me. I already know. I mean, it's not really a secret ballot, so it's all good. But we enjoy interacting with you. We enjoy seeing everybody on LinkedIn and all the comments that people are making on LinkedIn and continuing to see what we can bring you each week on our podcast. So until the next time, we'll see everybody on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.